As was mentioned in the introduction, today's sermon will be dealing with the Song of Moses. It's an interesting concept and what was said and what was done many, many, many years ago. But it's also interesting that this we find over in the book of Revelation, chapter 15, that we read about a heavenly choir singing a song. And what song they are singing has a lot to do with us today. And we need to recognize what impact it does have on what we are, who we are. So let's read, the first few verses of Revelation 15 and see what God said, inspired by Christ in the book of Revelation, chapter 15, that there is a group of people. And he says, I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous. Then seven angels were having the seven last plagues. For in them is filled up the wrath of God. And I saw as there were a sea of glass mingled with fire. So at the same time as there was a situation which was the wrath of God, he also saw as it were a sea of glass mingled with fire. And them that had gotten the victory over the beast and over his image and over his mark and over the number of his name stand on the sea of glass having harps of God. If you've never been a musician, you are going to be a musician someday, okay? If you have never sung before, we are all going to sing one day a song. And it says, and they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, this same psalm is both called the song of Moses and the song of the Lamb. And the reason it is the same is because it's the process is always the same of what God does, how he works, whether it be in ancient Israel or in our lives today, God's way of doing things does not change. It is the same. And so they are given these harps of God and they sing this song of Moses and of the Lamb. And this is what it says, great and marvelous are your works, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are your ways, O King of Saints. Who shall not fear you, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you only are holy. For all nations shall come and worship before you, for your judgments are made manifest. So here we find that God says the reason these people come and are singing this song is because God's work is finished at that time and completed, and that we need to recognize God for who God is and what God is and what he is doing today, how he used this many years ago. So what is this mysterious Song of Moses, and does it have any impact? Does it have anything for us today? It's been some like 3,500 years now since this song was sung in ancient Israel, and when God inspired Moses to write down his words. In actual fact, the term Song of Moses really is not a correct term, because God inspired the words given to Moses to be written down. They weren't Moses' words, as we will find as we go through. They were God's words. They were inspired by God as a great lesson, as a witness for all of mankind. So 3,500 years ago, God first taught this song. I think it's time that we begin to learn that song, that we learn what is being said and the words of what that song pictures. It is a witness, as we will find, to all of mankind, all humanity, they will have a witness to what God is doing. So I'm going to go through a little bit of background as we turn back to the book of Deuteronomy, and a little bit of background about this song and what it was and what was being done. I'll be reading somewhat of it out of the Jewish translation, the Jewish Society Bible, because they put it actually in poetry style as a song, literally, not like the King James that puts it in prose. In the Jewish translation, it is actually as a song that we will sing. So we need to go back and look at a little bit of the background and what this time was and what kind of a place it was for us today. In looking at some of the materials that we can have, this song will only be effective or if we allow God to have his work. And he will bring many people to repentance through what these words picture and what the words say. Some will be in this day and age. Some will be later. If you read the rest of what it says there in Revelation chapter 15, actually these people come out of the tribulation and the day of the Lord. They come through the tribulation and the trials, and then they stand singing the song of Moses. So we need to go back and pick up a little bit of what it was like. And so we find the commission for us today in chapter 31 of the book of Deuteronomy, in verse 16 through 22, a little bit of the background of the book in Deuteronomy 31. The actual song itself is in Deuteronomy 32. But picking up a little bit here in Deuteronomy chapter 31 and verse 16. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, you shall sleep with your fathers, and this people will rise up, and they will go a-whoring after the gods of the strangers on the land, whither they go to be among them, and will forsake me, and they will break my covenant which I have made with them." So here God was telling Moses that this people are going to turn away from me, and they're going to go after other gods. And it says in verse 17, "And then my anger will be kindled against them." So again, the process that as people turn away from God, that God will use punishment and penalties as a way to bring people back to him. We always have to remember, whether it's in our lives today or whether it's in the lives of Israel in old, that the whole purpose for the tribulation and for the trials and for the tests that will come upon the whole world, the only purpose for them is to help people return to God. To be able to return to the God who made them. The whole purpose is not just to punish any more than it is for us to punish our children. We punish in order for them to return to an attitude of obedience, right? And servant. And God does the same thing. So going on here, he says, Then my anger will be kindled against them in that day, verse 17, and I will forsake them. In other words, I'm going to let them go their own way. And I will hide my face from them. In one sense, in other translations, it's more that I will allow them to do, and my back will somewhat be turned to them. And they shall be devoured. I kind of get the impression, it's kind of like if you knew your son was going totally contrary to what God was, and he was going all these things, and he would not listen, as a parent, you really wouldn't want to watch what was going on, would you? You would kind of like to just, okay, if that's what you've decided to do, I don't want to have to see you have to go through all the suffering. But he says, coming on over in verse 17, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles will befall them, so that they will say in that day, are not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us? That finally, they will come to the point where they're at least going to ask a question. Why in the world are we suffering the way we're suffering? Why are we getting the penalties? Why are we having all of the difficulties, the famines and the pestilences and all of the other things that are upon society? Is it perhaps because God's not among us? So then in verse 18 going on, he says, and I will then surely hide my face in that day for all of the evils which they have wrought in that they have turned to other gods. But now therefore write you this song for you, or write you this song for you, and teach it to the children of Israel, and put it in their mouths, that this song may be a witness for me against the children of Israel. So even today, it also applies to our spiritual journey, that this song is a witness between God and ourselves. And verse 20 says, for when I have brought them into the land which I swore unto their fathers, that flows with milk and honey, and they shall have eaten and filled themselves and waxen fat, then will they turn. Because of this message, and many people in the world will turn and understand when all of the tribulations and things come, because we have made that message available, right? Of what's going to happen. Whether it be in the pages of the Good News magazine or over the Beyond Today telecast. Our mission and our job is to preach the song of Moses as a witness. For us in our lives, what we need to do, and why I'm giving the sermon today, is that let it be a witness for us, that all of us can recognize what God says and why he says it. In verse 21 he says, or 20, for when I shall have brought them into the land which I swore unto their fathers, that flows with milk and honey, and they shall have eaten and filled themselves and waxed fat, and then will they turn unto gods and serve them and provoke me and break my covenant. And it shall come to pass, when many evils and troubles have befallen them, that this song will testify against them as a witness. For it shall not be forgotten out of the mouths of their seed. In other words, the future generations will recognize the words that I inspired Moses to put down in that book and in that song. For I know their imagination, for they shall go about even now before I have brought them into the land which I swore. And so Moses therefore wrote this song the very same day. What day was that? The day he was going to die. Realize this song in Deuteronomy chapter 32 were the last words that God inspired Moses to give to his people before God told Moses to go up on top of Mount Abiram or Mount Nebo, and you're going to die. So I would imagine, since the people of children of Israel knew that this was Moses' last day of life, he probably had a pretty wrapped group of people he was talking to, right? That they would have been listening to what he says, because they were looking at having their leader that they've been leading them, guiding them now for 40 years through good and bad, many times of difficulty, but they had seen Moses as their one who went to God for them, and who pleaded with God on their behalf at times. And they knew this was the last time they were going to see Moses as face. And so they would have been recalling the time when they saw Moses come down from Mount Horeb as his face was shining bright, right? They would have been recalling the time that he probably got mad and angry at the waters, right? They probably would have been recalling the time when Nadab and Abihu rebelled. Perhaps they were recalling the time when Miriam turned leprous because she rebelled against the authority of what God was doing, and they were criticizing Moses, and she turned into a leper. So they would have been recalling all of things. And so this song of Moses is the song written on the day of Moses' death. The day he died. And these were the last will and testament in that way, right? The last will and testament of Moses that he was giving. So they probably would have been thinking of that man that they have now seen for the last 40 years, that shortly after these words were spoken, that he was going to make a last final trip up the mountain. And he was not going to come back down. That was going to be one way or the other, somehow or the other, God was going to take his life up there. One author says that he likes to think of it as the last kiss of God to Moses. And he died, all right? And he died. But they probably would have been thinking about all of the personal ties and all the warm friendships, the serious exhortations. They probably would have thought about the many times that he had intervened for them when they didn't have water or they didn't have food. So there was a serenity and a sense of awe and wonderment that gripped the people here as they were living there on the other side of the Jordan, waiting to cross over the Jordan with a new leader under the governments of a new man of Joshua. So it's very doubtful that they could at this time have hidden their love for Moses and their affection for Moses, because love has a way of winning out in the long run. Despite how mad they got at Moses at first many times, they had to have loved him and cared a lot for him because they had seen how patient he was and most of the time and how loving he was to them. And love, you know, has a way of winning out in the long run. It does. If nothing else works, try love. Try love, and it usually will work, right? In the long run. In the long run. So they had probably remembered all of the times that they had had Moses go and meet with God over there at that tent that was just outside of where the rest of them were. And they had seen Moses talking with God face to face for 40-some years now. And now, great moments such as this one where he records this song don't come very often in a lifetime. Great moments such as this have not come in our lives. When they do, few are aware of the great drama. But here, the whole nation of Israel was awake. But the point we need to also realize is that the song of Moses is not for that generation only, but it's for our generation today too. It's for us. It's not only a chronicle of history. I mean, in the days of when Moses gave the psalm, most of it was prophecy, little of it was history. As we read it today, most of it is history, and little of it is prophecy, right? Most of it has been done and fulfilled. But there are still things that God says are going to come to pass. And so we need to look at this song and recognize what God is doing in our lives. Probably their eyes were full of tears as they were listening to what Moses was saying. They probably could not hold back their sorrow and tears, knowing that this was the last time that their beloved leader would speak to them, that this would be the last opportunity forever to hear that man plead with him and talk with him. So this was no ordinary song. This song was never to be forgotten. It was never to be allowed to slip from our memory. So this song was never to be forgotten, and it was to be make certain of that. The Lamb of God picked up the song, and he made people learn it and taught it to the saints. And so today, as we look at this psalm, let's not only think of it as the last words of Moses, but the words of Christ himself and what he did. So we will see Moses as a prophet. And as a prophet, sometimes there is unhappiness about knowing things that will come to pass. It has been revealed to Moses that what would happen at his passing. Can you imagine what must have been going through Moses' mind when God tells him in this song, after your death, this people that you have loved and cherished and helped and guided are going to totally turn from all of the guidance and the direction and the inspiration and all of the love that you have shown to them. Moses must have been hurt to the bone to think, you mean these people are going to totally reject you? But they were. And God had told Moses they're going to, what was going to happen after his death and after he passed. Going back over to Deuteronomy 31, I'm going to pick up a few other verses in Deuteronomy 31 and verse 24. And it says, and it came to pass that when Moses had made an end of writing the words of this law in a book until they were finished, that God commanded the Levites, which bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, saying, take you this book of the law and put it in the side of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, that it may be there for a witness against you. For I know your rebellion and your stiff neck, and behold, while I am yet alive with you this day, you have been rebellious against the Lord, and how much more will you be rebellious after my death? So God told him to put it in the ark or beside the ark, that it was going to be part of the record that was to be kept about them. In verse 27 to 30, coming on down, he says, verse 28, and gather therefore unto me all of the elders of your tribes and your officers, that I may speak you these words in their ears, and call heaven and earth to record against them. For I know that after my death you will utterly corrupt yourselves, and you will turn aside from the way which I have commanded, and evil will befall you in the latter days. Some of those are still in the future. We as a people, modern day Israel, are facing some calamitous times in the near future because you will do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger through the works of your hands. And so then, verse 30, and Moses spoke then in the ears of all of the congregation of Israel the words of this song until they were ended. And so then he takes this opportunity in verse chapter 32, and he records this song, the song of Moses and the song of the Lamb. So now let's go back and have a look at certain parts of this song of Moses or of Christ and see how we can learn from it. Going back to Deuteronomy 32, and I will use the Jewish translation in Deuteronomy 32. And we first of all learned in the first few verses of chapter 32 how truth comes and how truth is given to ancient Israel and to us. But he says, "Hear, give ear, you heavens, and I will speak. And let the earth hear the words of my mouth. My doctrine shall drop as the rain, and my speech shall distill as the dew, as the small rain upon the tender grass, and as the showers upon the herb. For I will proclaim the name of the Lord and ascribe you greatness unto our God." Think back to your life. How did God begin to open your mind and your understanding of truth? It doesn't come like a thunder shower or a bolt of lightning. God says here that the truth, it comes as the dropping of the rain and as the distilling of the dew and as a small rain over a long process of time that God, through his spirit that is pictured by this rain, begins to open up our hearts and our minds to understand more and more of the truth that he has for us. It doesn't all happen at once, does it? Little by little. I thought it was very interesting that God doesn't liken it to a bolt of lightning, but as gentle rain, as the distilling of the dew upon the land, upon the ground. And that's what we need to recognize and see in our lives, that that's how God works in our life. And so I want to just cover a couple of points regarding that in some articles that I was reading about how God does that. It's interesting the way he puts it. Yes, the truth distilled as the dew and the gentle rain, and that is the way it should be. God has not chosen the lightning bolts to strike his people, nor the thunder to define his truths. They are finding out in our time today, the miracle of the dew and the rain. And it is a miracle. Every time you see dew or rain, you know it's a divine miracle. Because water is heavier than air. It shouldn't be able to do what it does. But God does it, right? Every time we hear truth, it is a miracle from God, as much as the rain or as the dew falling. You don't do it on your own. You and I cannot understand it on our own. It is a miracle. And it's today, scientifically, they are beginning to realize how much of a miracle it is. It says, scientifically, water is much heavier than air, and theoretically, air should not hold water. But it does. How it does it? Well, that is the miracle. Water simply evaporates into the air. And we all know that is true. But he said, by the way of contrast to the great deluge, you know, God didn't bring the truth into your life by the deluge prior to the flood, right? Or prior, before Moses' time, or Noah's time, like the rains came then. What God does is he gives it little by little. So by way of contrast, the dew forms from the moisture condensing from the air on the earth in such a gentle way that it forms droplets of water without the sound of a drop of rain, without any noise, without any racket. What God does is he just gradually opens the mind to be able to understand and to drink in of the water of the heavens and the dew. If God poured out his knowledge like the deluge, we probably would be, it would run off, right? You wouldn't be able to comprehend it. You wouldn't be able to absorb it and take it in. So God has to create the conditions for us. And that's how the truth comes into our lives. Like the dew, as it says here in the first part of the book of Deuteronomy chapter 32. Think about your life. Think about how it must have looked to the people, the children of Israel. As the showers upon the herb, for I will proclaim the name of the Lord. Second part that we need to think about is how and who God really is. And that's covered in the next few verses about the rock. The rock that God says he is, and not, you know, what we think about. So he says, the rock, his work is perfect. For all his ways are justice, a God of faithfulness and without iniquity. Just stop there for a moment, because many times people think of God as a great power. That's correct. But I have heard and have witnessed individuals who do not necessarily think that all of his ways are justice. That we have, as human beings, sometimes taken upon ourselves the right to decide whether God was right or wrong in certain areas of how he did certain things or what he said. I believe, based on what God says, God is always right. Okay. No matter how it may look to us, no matter how we might think, well, couldn't there have been a better way? God is always right. And we will come to see that as time goes by. God does not need to change. God does not need to alter his thinking. He never does. You know, sometimes people think, well, God changed from the old to the new. God didn't change. He didn't change anything. His nature didn't change. His ways didn't change. People like to make a big dichotomy between the old covenant and the new covenant. God's the same yesterday, today, and forever. That's the big lesson in Deuteronomy chapter 32 about the Song of Moses. And it will be a witness to all of us that God is always right. Sometimes when we read through the scriptures, we might question about, well, is this really right, or did God change his way? God didn't change his ways on anything. You know that? Interesting that even the alteration that took place as far as the sacrificial system and the Levitical priesthood. Guess which priesthood came first? The Melchizedek priesthood or the Levitical priesthood? Which one was first? The Melchizedek priesthood was first, prior to the giving of the Levitical one. It didn't. So God doesn't change. There are different requirements at differing times for differing reasons. But he doesn't alter his thinking, his way. And that's one of the big lessons in Deuteronomy 32, as in the Song of Moses, that points out over and over and over again. God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He never alters. We humans might need to change our thinking. We might come to see him differently. But God doesn't change. how God works with human beings doesn't change. You know, God works with us spiritually the same way he worked with the children of Israel. Goes through the same steps. I give you my law. I want you to obey it. If you don't obey it, you're going to get punished. And the reason I punish you is to bring you into a jealous state of wanting to return to me, right? That's why he punishes us. That's why he gives us tests and challenges so that we will return to him. And so he says, the rock, his work is perfect. For all his ways are justice. A God of faithfulness and without iniquity. Just and right is he. You know, his corruption, is corruption his? No, his children is the blemish. It's not God. God isn't the one at fault. Remember what it says in Hebrews chapter 8? About the new covenant when it was being given, or the renewed covenant, or the new covenant, or whatever. Remember, whose fault was it that was the problem? Was it God's? No, Hebrews chapter 8 says in verse 8, finding fault with them, right? The people. We human beings, we're the ones who are at fault. If there's ever a disagreement between God and human beings, guess who's wrong? Not God, it's us. So it's important that we recognize, because that's what we think of when you think of a rock. It doesn't change. It's hard. It doesn't alter through rain or snow, or it doesn't wear down. Now, some rocks do, obviously, but when God uses the type that he is the rock, he is so solid and so right and so absolutely faithful. Very important that all peoples come to understand that a God of faithfulness and without iniquity, just and right is he. So is corruption his? No, his children is the blemish. A crooked generation, perverse. Do you thus requite the Lord, O foolish people and unwise? Is not he your father that has gotten you? Has he not made you and established you? Do we come to see God for who God is? How God is? How he works in our lives, how much we need to rely upon him. There are many scriptures in the Bible that talk about rock, the rock of God. Isaiah 51 and verse 1 says, from the English Standard Version of the Bible, the English Standard Version is a modern, updated version of the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, okay? This is the English Standard Version. It says, look to the rock from which you were hewn. It says in Psalm 18, verse 2, the Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, and my rock in whom I will take refuge. And in 2 Samuel 22, it says, the rock of Israel has said to me, when one rules justly over men, ruling in the fear of God, he dawns on them like the morning light. Can you see when Christ returned that it's going to be like a morning light when the sun begins to come up over the horizon and we begin to see a new day coming. The third section of the book of Deuteronomy 32 is in chapter 32, verses 7 to 9, where he basically is saying to Jacob that he had his allotted heritage. Now, this was probably important for them that they remembered from history, referring back to Genesis chapter 10, where God had separated the nations and set the boundaries. And in Genesis 10, where we find that the 70 people were assigned their portions of the land shortly after the flood, but their fathers and elders probably remembered this history. And it was important to the children of Israel then because they were standing at the gate of the promised land. And it was important for them to know the land they were going in to possess, where they were going to take and destroy many differing peoples. They needed to know that the land that they were going in to possess was because God had given it to them as a heritage. They were not taking something that did not belong to them. It was theirs. The ones that were there were the usurpers, including the Canaanites, the Hittites, including the Hivites, the Jebusites. They were the interlopers. They were the settlers who had gone in and taken land that did not belong to them. And so the children of Israel needed to know that as they were going into the land. And sometimes what we need to understand as we read history is that this land belonged to Israel from the time of Genesis chapter 10. He had already set the bounds of it. And so he says it was to Eber was born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in the days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. And it was in Peleg's time that the earth was divided. And Peleg followed in the lineage of Shem. And we think this scrap of history is very interesting even now. But then it was a reminder that they were claiming their own heritage when they were going into the take over the land of Palestine. I would suggest it might do well if some other people today recognized that. That perhaps we wouldn't have all of the problems we have in modern day society with people thinking that Jerusalem belongs to and ought to be a divided city. Whoever said it was supposed to be a divided city? But you know, here we are in our pompous attitudes over here in the West right now. And we can sit there and think, oh, you dumb Jews. I mean, you obnoxious Jews. Why don't you just give part of the city and part of your land to the Palestinians and let them own it? I mean, who are we over here where we have a huge country to tell a little nation of Israel, divide your land and give half of it to somebody else? Doesn't make sense. But the only thing of it is, most of our politicians haven't read the Bible either, had you know that? And they don't know history. And so he says that it was important for Israel to recognize as they were going in so that they didn't get the feeling that we are being cruel and we are not being smart in what we're doing, but that we are being given this land because it was ours from the beginning. It was ours from the beginning. It's interesting then, and back there in Genesis 10, that it actually says that God established the borders of the nations in respect to Israel. How he established the differing boundaries of nation all had to do with Israel and who they were and who they were to become. And it would do well for all of us to recognize that. As it says in the latter part of the verse 9 and 10, for the portion of the Lord is his people, and Jacob the lot of his inheritance. Back up in verse 8, where he says, when the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the children of men, he set the borders of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. I believe what God says, and I believe he has a right to what he says, that he's the one who establishes the bound. And it helps us when we look at that, even in today's world, that we can understand that. We'll go to one other section then of the book of Deuteronomy 32. We'll cover just two more sections, and then we will leave the rest for the next sermon. But he was found in a desert land. He says he found him in a desert land and in the waste, and he was in a howling wilderness, and he compassed him about, and he cared for him. Always use these statements and analogies to think of ourselves, that we also were found in a desert land, weren't we? Full of sin and corruption, cut off from God. So he compassed him about, and he cared for him, and he kept him as the apple of his eye. That God's eye was on Israel from the very start. It never fluctuated. Even through difficult times, Israel was always the apple of his eye. It still is. It still is. So he kept them as that apple. It doesn't get any better than that, does it? Think of yourself as being in God's eyes as the apple of his eye. Pretty fantastic. It's wonderful to be kept by the power of God. One last section in verses 11 and 12 that I'd like to just think about. It has to do with the eagle stirring up its nest. How God deals with us. How does he handle us as human beings? Same way as as an eagle cares for its own. He says in verse 11, so as an eagle that stirs up her nest, hovering over her young, spreading abroad her wings and taking them, bearing them on her pinions, the Lord alone did lead him, and there was no strange God with him. Eagle is an amazing and astonishing creature. It really is. God uses it to mean many differing things. And so he says here that this eagle, you know what, the Lord uses the eagle to illustrate his care for Israel. It is a remarkable creature. It can use high winds to soar to great heights. It has keen vision. Such keen vision that it can see a mouse from a mile high. That's pretty good eyesight, right? That it can see a mouse in the grass from a mile up. But not only can it see a mouse from a mile up, that same eagle can look directly into the sun and not harm its eyesight. I mean, we can't look into the sun, can we? Even from where we are. But it can look at the sun at noonday. It speaks of the eagle stirring up her nest. Because eagles make their nests out of twigs and out of limbs and parts of trees. Usually high up in the trees, by the way. But when eagles become of age to leave the nest, the mother eagle will tear out all of the grass and the down that's inside the nest. And suddenly those little eaglets are no longer quite so comfortable. And now they feel these twigs poking them rather than before. They had all this down and they had all the grass and everything else, but now the mother eagle has gone in. and pull all the nice soft stuff out so that the little eaglets feel only the wood and the twigs and the other stuff. So what it does is it kind of makes them realize this isn't quite such a comfortable place to be, right? This is not the best place. So as the twigs began to poke and the sticks began to irritate them, the eaglets become to realize that, well, it's time to leave the nest. It's such an amazing analogy of how God works with us. He begins to tear out all the soft stuff, doesn't he? When you've been in the church for very long, guess what? He leaves you to where you feel the roughage. You feel the twigs and you feel the branches and you recognize that that eagle's nest isn't quite as nice as it used to be. And so as the eaglets then spread their wings while learning to fly on their rocky ledges, the mother eagle then flutters over her young. And on their maiden voyage, they actually will fly underneath the eaglet so that they don't fall, teaching them how to do that. God says that's the way he teaches us. And then the last thing that the eaglets have to learn, which we also need to learn, is that how to soar. What eagles need to learn as young eaglets by their parents teaching them is how to use their wings to get the wind, to properly soar with the wind. If they didn't show them how to do that, they would be battling themselves to death, fighting all of the wind that would be not being used to their advantage. What the eagles teach them is how to adjust their wings, to harness the opposing winds. What God teaches us is how to adjust to the trials, adjust to the winds, adjust to the difficulties, so that we can learn to use those difficulties to soar by the Spirit of God in a way that he wants us to do. So we must learn to soar on eagle's wings. We must learn to use the opposing forces of life to soar to higher and higher heights by renewing our strength, as it says in the book of Isaiah, as the eagle. And so the eagle does not fight the opposing winds, but it harnesses them while renewing its strength. And that's what we must do. And that's all in this one song, which we need to learn to sing. Next time we'll pick up there and we'll cover the rest of the book of Deuteronomy 32 and the song of Moses that is our song. And we need to learn to sing it.